We're holding on Chafvav Amud Beis, the fourth line of the wide lines. I'm checking out the fifth line, rather. We're talking about Tashmishi Kedusha and Tashmishi Mitzvah, where we said Tashmishi Mitzvah are things where you use it for a mitzvah, but it itself doesn't have intrinsic Kedusha. For example, we said a sukkah, a lulav, etc., where in principle you're allowed to throw them away afterwards. So the minhag is that at least you don't treat them with bizoyim. The sukkah, for example, it says you're not allowed to step on the schach, the arovus from the lulav also, you're not supposed to step on. People save their lulavim and use them to burn together with the chametz, but me'ikar adin, you're allowed to throw them out as long as you don't treat them with bizoyim. On the other hand, we said tashmishi kedusha, things that are used directly for items that have intrinsic kedusha. For example, we said cases for sfarim or bags for tefillin and things like that. Though, and the ritzuris of tefillin, those have intrinsic kedusha, and those have to be put in shapes. So we talked about a few things where we said, for example, Rava had said that the poroiches he thought was tashmish to tashmish, because it's serving the aron, which in turn is serving the sifrei Torah in it. So therefore, maybe you shouldn't have intrinsic kedusha. It should be like no different than the shul itself. But then he saw that sometimes they take the paroiches and wrap the and put the sefer Torah on it. So therefore, it's considered a tashmish kedusha. Nowadays, if they don't do that, in fact, it says in Shulchan Aruch that the paroiches only has the din of like the rest of the shul building. So it doesn't have the same degree of intrinsic kedusha. The paroiches in front of the aron, yeah. Other things like that. So for Omar Rava, Hani Zvili de Chumashi, the Zvili of Chumashim, Rashi translates that Zvili is like we had before in the Gemara Dulus. We had in the Gemara before Dulus Gemei Sfarim, which meant like cases, so like bags for Sfarim. So Rashi says that Zvili means something similar for Chumashim. Chumashim in those times, remember, were written like Sifrei Torah on scrolls, but individual Chumashim rather than all five together. The Aruch gives a different explanation that Zvili the Chumashi means sort of like a frame. The Aruch describes it as like a leather frame that they use to put around the sefer. Whatever the case, so it's some kind of case or cover for the sefer. The Kamtere de Sifri and the boxes that they use, the boxes in which they put Sfarim. Tashmish kedusha ninu v'nignozim. So those are considered a tashmish kedusha. Therefore, when they wear out, you have to put them in shemus. You can't just use them for mundane purposes. So gemara says pshita. Obviously, what else would you think they are if not tashmish kedusha? And the answer is ma'udat tema hani lav l'chaved avinan. You would think, without Rava telling you, maybe these things are not made for covered for the sefer l'naturi ba'alma avini. They're really only made in order to protect the sefer. Kamash malan. Therefore, Rava is telling us that not. Now, you have two ways that Rishonim learn this answer of the Gemara. Are we saying that, in fact, it's incorrect to think that they're only for Shmira? They are, in fact, for covered, implying, therefore, that if you had something that was strictly for Shmira, then it wouldn't have to be put in Shemus, and you could use it for some other purpose. Or are we saying that, no, even if it's only for Shmira, nevertheless, you still need to put it in Shemus? A nafka minna, for example, so the Urzarua, a Rishon, talks about what if you have, for example, so like you, in most shuls, you have the Oren Kodesh sticks out from the wall, like this one and most other ones. But sometimes you have, for example, where there's a niche in the wall, there's like the wall itself is set back, and then you keep the Sefer Torah in there. So now, is that considered? Is that considered something that's only there in order to protect the Sfarim? So if you say, if you learn the Gemara as saying that where it's only there to protect them, then it doesn't have kedusha, then it would mean such an Aron Kodesh does not have kedusha. On the other hand, if you say that it does, then it does. So the Mishnah Berurah points out that if in that niche they build a fancy Aron Kodesh, then yeah, for sure that's for the covered of the Torah, and therefore that would have the din of a regular Aron Kodesh. But what if, in other words, like you just have a niche over there, and like you put the Sifrei Torah in there, and like you put a Paroiches in front of it or something?
What's that mean? I don't understand the differences. So what's the difference if it's inside or outside?
Because the difference is that if it's a niche in the wall, then it's not really. The niche was not necessarily made for the Sfarim, and even to the extent it is, it's not really for the covered of the spot of the Sifrei Torah. It's just practically speaking in order to guard. So the Ramah brings that Urzarua and says that such a thing, in fact, would not have the Kedusha of an Oren Kodesh. So it would mean, in other words, that if eventually they renovate the shul, for example, and they take down the wood and the plaster and whatever that made up that niche, then they would be allowed to use it for other purposes. It wouldn't have the din of an Oren Kodesh. is what the Amor is saying. Another similar naftamina they talk about, for example, you have in this Aron Kodesh over here, and in many Aronis Kodesh in different shuls around the world, they have a safe inside the Aron Kodesh. Now you think of it, the Aron itself, the outside of the Aron, for sure is there for the covered of the Sifrei Torah. It's not really there in order to protect them, but the safe is really more in order to protect them. So therefore, that safe might be the same din as what the Ur Zeruah is saying about the niche. And therefore, when the safe itself wears out and they have to replace it, then the safe itself, you might be able to throw away or melt down or sell it as scrap metal or whatever, rather than having it have intrinsic kedusha and have to put it in chains.
That's one of two separate pieces, sort of.
We're talking about, yeah, like in other words, you have a safe inside the own kedusha, right? Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara tells another story involving a shul and an Aron Kodesh. Hahu beit knishta de Yehudoi Roimori. There was a shul of Jews who had come from Rome. So they came from Rome to Mechuzah. Now it's interesting. I mean, Rome and Mechuzah are a couple thousand miles apart. How do Jews, we don't just mean Jews from the Roman Empire, but Pashas, we mean from the actual city of Rome. How do they wind up in Mechuzah? You actually find in history books from those times that there were several times when the Romans invaded parts above them. Sometimes they kind of conquered them for greater or lesser amounts of time. So apparently at some time during that time, Jews from Rome, or Mestama, they weren't necessarily part of the Roman army, but they were along with them as assistants or to sell them supplies or whatever it is. And so they went, enough of them wound up in Mechuzah that they had a shul of their own. Anyway. So to have a they had this shul, to have a posiach lahu idroina. The shul was opened up into another room to have a machis bay mess. In that room, there was a mess. They had the mess was there. They hadn't yet taken the mess out to bury him. Now the problem is that the Kohenim wanted to be able to go into the shul, and they can't because the door is open between the two rooms, and the pashas, there wasn't a door. There was just like a hallway or something, and therefore the truma is going to come in. But that's the problem. Kohenim wanted to go and daven in the shul. And what can they do as long as the mess is there? So they came and told the Rava, who was the Rav and the Rosh Yeshiva in Mechuzah. So he tells them, Dalu Tevusa, pick up the Teva, the Oroin, the Oroin with the Sifrei Torah, and put it over there. Or Bapashtus, he means when the Oroin is empty. They didn't always keep the Sefer Torah in the Oren in the shul. Many times what they would do is, and you even see this sometimes, there are some shuls where they do this nowadays also. They have the Oren in the shul, but then afterwards they would take the Sefer Torah out and put it someplace in somebody's house for safekeeping or whatever. So Papashtus here was the same kind of thing. So Rava tells them, take the Oren, and put it in that hallway to block the doorway or the window or whatever it is. Different Rishonim talk about there may have been just a window between this room and the next room. To have a kli eitz ha'osu l'nachas. Now the good of it is that the Aron Kodesh is a wooden keli that's meant to stay in one place. It's not usually moved around from one place to another. Such a wooden keli is not makabel tuma, and therefore v'chotzitz b'fnei tuma. Therefore, it'll block the tuma from the other room from coming into the shul, and now the kohenim will be able to come in. But the chachamim of the yeshiva told Rava that doesn't work. Sometimes they move the Aron Kodesh when the Sefer Torah is on it or in it. And in that case, then it's a kliyetz which is moved when it's full as well as when it's empty. And the din is when you have a wooden keli that is only moved when it's empty, then it's not makabel tumah, because then the point is like this: for a wooden keli to be makabel tumah, it has to be similar to a sack, because the pasuk puts in one, the pasuk mentions back to back, so you have a hekesh between kli eitz and sack. So now, just like a sack, you carry it sometimes empty, sometimes full. The same way, for a wooden keli to be makabel tumah, it has to be that it's moved sometimes empty and sometimes full. So Rava thought that they never moved the Aron Kodesh at all. But they pointed out to him, not only do they move it, but sometimes they move it even with the Sefer Torah inside it. So therefore, v'havalei metal to the mala v'rekam. So therefore, it's moved empty, or therefore it's moved sometimes full, sometimes empty.
What's about the Mishnayos we learn in the back of the, you know, for
yeah, sorry, for Shlosha Tris and Enzin.
If you have a big keli that's considered.
So what about if you have Baba Midah? So the Ritva talks about that. He says there's two things. If the keli is, but first of all, he says, I mean, so what's the story? You measure the Aron Kodesh, see whether it holds 40 saw or not. He says there's two different things. There can be a keli that holds 40 saw, where there it's not makabel tumah, like the examples you're mentioning from those Mishnayos. from Shloisha Tris in Ein, then you have where it's less than 40 sa, but if it always stays in one place and you don't move it, so that was the situation. The Aron Kodesh over here is smaller than 40 sa. However, Rava thought that they usually always keep it in one place and they never move it with the Sefer Torah, and they're telling him it's not so. So Rava says, in that case, then you're right, there's no alternative. They're going to have to take out the mess before any Kohenim can come into the shul. By the way, the Poskim learn from this, I think the Ma'aril talks about this, a point you see from this, that if there's a mess in a house, the Kohenim, and then preventing the Kohenim from being able to go in there, the Kohenim don't have the right to say to the guy, you better get your mess out of here, it's interfering with us. When they're going to do the Levaya, they'll take out the mess, but they can't force him to take it out preterm.
It's not covered a mess.
It's not covered a mess to just take him out. Right. Yeah. Okay. More dinim about Tashmish Eklusha, Omer Mazutra, Mitpachoy Svarim Shabolu, the cloths, the mantlach or whatever that they wrap Svarim and Sifrei Torah in, if those wear out, Oisin Tachrichin the mess mitzvah, then what they should do is they should make them as Tachrichin for a mess mitzvah. Vizui gnizos, and that's how you put them in gniza. In other words, instead of just burying them in the ground, use them for a mitzvah, which is also binding on the tzibur. These cloths were used by the tzibur to wrap up their sifrei Torah. Now, a mess mitzvah is also chal on the tzibur, therefore, use it as tachrichin for him. V'omar Rava, similarly, Rava says, sefer Torah shabala, if a sefer Torah wears out, you can't read from it anymore, guns in oisa, etzot tamat chacham. They put it in Gniza by burying it next to a Tamar Chacham. And it doesn't have to be a Tamar Chacham, even like a high-level Tamar Chacham, but afilu shona halachas, even if he's only on the level where he learned Mishnayis and Braises, that's enough of a respectful place to put the Sefer Torah. Omer of Achaba Yaakov will be Kli Cheres. So Achaba Yaakov says, when you're burying it there, though, you should bury it in an earthenware container. Because that way, at least it doesn't start rotting right away. At least that way, the earthenware container will preserve it for some amount of time. So this way, it's not right away going to go start rotting. Shenema, as we see in a pasuk, where Hashem tells Yirmiyah to preserve a document for a long time, and he tells him, you should put it in an earthenware container, l'man yam yamim rabim, so it'll last for a long time. So the same way over here, you do that, and that way, at least it has a chance of lasting a while. You see, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls were in earthenware containers, and they lasted a couple of thousand years. It is also there. It was a dry climate. It's by the Dead Sea, so it's a little different. But still, you know, not in the water. They found them in caves. They found them in caves near the Dead Sea. But they were in earthenware containers, and many of them were still in a decent state of preservation, even after 1800 years or so. Yeah. For Amara Papi Mishmeder Rav Mi Beik Nishda Labeira Bonan Shori. If you want to take a place that used to be a shul and turn it into Beis Medrash, then that's allowed. Mi Bei Rabbanan, the Bei Knishta also, but the other way around, to take a Beis Medrash and turn it into a shul would be also because it's going down a level in Kedusha.
Which one's more holy?
So which one was holier? We're saying the Bei Rabbanan, the yeshiva. The yeshiva has a greater degree of Kedusha. V'rapapa, Mishmei the Rava, Masni Ikha. Now, on the other hand, so that was Rapapi said in the name of Rava. Sorry, I'd said Rav. In the name of Rava, had said that it's a lot, that's how it is. Rav Papa learns in the name of Rava the other way. So, which version do we follow? Amar Rav Acha, have a say that a papi mistabra. It's more logical to go according to Rav Papi's version, namely that a Beis Medrash has a greater kedusha than a shul, and therefore that you can upgrade from a shul to a Beis Medrash, but not the other way around. To Amar Rav Yeshua ben Levi, because we see that Rav Yeshua ben Levi says Beis Hakneses Motol Asay say Beis Medrash. Shmamino, so this, since Rabbi Shlomo Levi said that, we can accept that. Tosfos points out, we're actually going to have a machloikas in a minute between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shlomo Levi. The fact that we say that we can follow Rabbi Shlomo Levi shows that that in general, when you have a machloikas between the two of them, the halachas are going to be like Rabbi Shlomo Levi. Bechlau, what you have is Rabbi Shlomo Levi was a generation before Rabbi Yochanan. I don't know if he was actually one of Rabbi Yochanan's rebbes, but he was a generation before him. The usual rule is that up until the time of Abaya and Rava, the halacha is usually like the earlier opinion. After the time of Abaya and Rava, since they started compiling shas as we know it, and therefore they had to know everything that everybody before them said, then from then on we usually say halacha kabasroi, the halacha is usually like the later authority. But up until that point, not, and that would be one reason, so Tosfos doesn't mention out of here, but that might be one reason why we're saying the halacha is like the Rishon Levi, because he's the previous generation before Rav Yechon.
So it's respecting for... for the elders, or could be the later generations more than.
So it's not so much respect for the elders. I mean, there's the idea that the scat and adurtus, that as the generations go by, then the later generations are of lesser caliber. But there's the idea, in other words, that up until the time of Abaye and Rava, let's say, for example, now when Rabbi Yochanan is saying his opinion, not necessarily does he know what Rabbi Shimon ben Levi said. Maybe we could say if he knew of what Rabbi Shimon ben Levi said, he might have changed his mind. So therefore, so we would say that the earlier generation, Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, being that he's closer to Matan Torah and is on a higher level, then we accept his opinion. Only after Abaye and Rava do we say differently. Because then it's their job to know what the later one said, what the earlier one said.
Abaye and Rava was the cutoff point.
Right. Okay. So, Dorash Bakapara, so in this connection, Bakapara said of Dorasha, my dichtiv, what does it mean when it describes the Churban at the end of Sefer Melachim? It says, Nebuzaradan came to Yerushalayim, Vayistrip is Beis Hashem, Beis Beis HaMelech. He burnt the house of Hashem, the Beis HaMikdash, and the house of the king, the palace, the Eskol Bote Yerushalayim, and all the houses of Yerushalayim, the Eskol Beis Godol Saraf Be'esh, and all the big houses he burnt in fire. So let's learn those phrase by phrase. So, Beis Hashem is Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMelech Elu Paltu Yerushalayim means the king's palace. The Eskol Bote Yerushalayim means Kimashmon, means exactly what it sounds like, the houses of the individual citizens of Yerushalayim. Now, what is the Eskol Beis Godol Saraf Be'esh? What does that mean? If it says they burnt all the houses, then obviously they burnt the big houses as well. So what is that adding? So Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Levi. So Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Levi argue what those words Beis Godol means. Chad Oma Mokam Shema Gadlin by Torah. One says, and we're going to show soon that it's that which one is which, that one of them says it's the place where they make tefillah, where they make Torah greater. They learn Torah, but they learn Torah Barabim, and in that way they're making the Torah greater. So it means the Bate Medrash. So Nebuzaradan burnt down the Bate Medrash that were in Yerushalayim. The other one says it means a place where they make tefillah greater, in other words, the shuls. Manda Amar Torah, the one who says that the Pasuk is referring to places of Torah, to Bate Medrash, where do we get that the word Godol is in connection with that? Hashem chafetz man sidkei. Hashem wanted, in order to give the Jewish people lots of tzedakah, in order to give them lots of sposim, yagdil Torah v'yadu, that he made the Torah great and glorious. So we see that Godol is associated with Torah. Manda Amar Tefillah, the opinion that says that it's places of Tefillah, where do we see that Godol was associated with Tefillah? Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says that at one point, the king of Yisrael asks Gehazi, Sapra na Hagdola Sasha also Elisha, tell me please of the great things that Elisha accomplished, and how did Elisha accomplish? Elisha da'abad, what Elisha did, Berachmi hu da'abad, he accomplished it by davening to Hashem. So therefore, so we see that davening is associated with the word Gedolah. Now, the Chassam Sofer has an interesting point. How do we know that Elisha did his nisim by davening to Hashem? Maybe he did it using names of Hashem.
But it's not
the same thing. Davening means you daven to Hashem, please do such and such. Names of Hashem means a person knows names of Hashem that he can use to accomplish nisim, like Sefer Yetzirah or whatever. So how do we know he didn't do with that? So one interesting answer is that we find that a person who has hana from other people is not supposed to use names of Hashem. And here, where we know that Elisha did that, because the Gemara in fact in Bracha says that a person is allowed, that Elisha, when he traveled from one place to another, he would accept achnasas arachim from people, for example, from the Isha of Shunamis and her husband, so therefore he wouldn't have been able to use names of Hashem like that. So therefore, of necessity, it has to be that he accomplished it through davening. A different other interesting point that they answer is that specifically, one of the nisim that Gehazi was telling the king about over there is that story where Elisha revived the son of the Isha Shunamis, and the Pasuk actually says there that he davened to Hashem, by Yispalel Hashem. It's an Aftorah, Parshas Vayera, so therefore it's clear that he did that through Tefillah. Another very interesting answer actually is that if he had done it using names of Hashem, then the child wouldn't have been able to speak ever afterwards. Then it would have been like, for example, when the Maharal created the Golem, or for example, you find in Sanhedrin, where Rava created a Golem using Sefer Yetzirah, where they're not able to speak. Right. Yeah, the Gemara mentions that Rava did. So only Hashem has the ability to give a person to speak. Therefore, if the child is able to speak afterwards, it means that he must have revived him using davening to Hashem. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Now, which one said which? We said Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Levi have their respective opinions, but which one said which? Tistayim did Rabbi Shimon ben Levi will draw a makom shem gadlin by Torah. We can conclude, we can demonstrate that Rabbi Shimon ben Levi is the one who says that Beis Godol means the Beis Medrash, the place where they make the Torah greater. Da'amar Rabbi Shimon ben Levi Beis Haknesses Motolasa is the Beis Medrash. We just said that he says they were allowed to turn a shul into a Beis Medrash, showing that he holds that Beis Medrash is greater than a shul. Therefore, the word Beis Godol is more appropriate for it. Shmamina. So that proves that that's what it is. He's the one who explains it that way. Rabbi Yochanan understands that it means the shuls.
Question. We couldn't have derived that from the fact that the Torah says limud Torah keneged kulam. So by definition, that should prove that a Beis Midrash is greater than a shul.
Well, okay, but on the other hand, we see that Rabbi Yochanan disagrees, and we see that Rabbi
How can you disagree?
Talmud Torah may be connected to Kulam. That doesn't mean that a place of Talmud Torah is necessarily greater than a place where you daven.
Of course it does.
No, it doesn't. There's two different things. There's the greatness of learning Torah, and then there's the greatness of the place where you learn Torah. You could still say, as great as learning Torah is, maybe a shul is more important. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying, and that's what Rabbi Papa was saying. So it's a valid point, but nevertheless, we're still saying that we follow Rabbi Shurban Leib.
They didn't bring any solid reason.
The reason was because he doesn't need a reason. He said he learns the pasuk that's called Beis Gadol Sarach Ba'Esh, and he's saying since it says Yag Yotod of Yadir, then it means therefore that Beis Medrash exceeds the kedusha of a shul. That's what it is. That's how Rabbi Shurban Leib learned, and that's what we're saying.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on. We said if the tzibur sold a sefer Torah, then they're not allowed to use the money to buy other svarim. So we have a question. Are they allowed to sell an older sefer Torah in order to use the money to buy a new one? Do we say on the one hand, they're not going up in Kedusha, so maybe it's also, maybe the Mishnah is implying that you always have to go up in Kedusha, and since there's nothing higher than a sefer Torah, then you can't. Since there's no higher that you can go, there's nothing that has higher kedusha than a sefer Torah, shapir dummy, maybe it would be fine. In other words, you could say the rest of the Mishnah, for example, where it says that if they sold svarim, they shouldn't be buying with it a teva, let's say, fine, because the alternative is don't buy a teva, buy a sefer Torah, go up in level. But here with a sefer Torah, you have no other alternative, so maybe you're allowed to go on the same level. So Tashma, let's try to bring a proof. The Mishnah had said, Aval Mochru Torah Leichu Svarim. The Mishnah says, if they sell a Sefer Torah, they're not allowed to use the money to buy Svarim, implying Svarim Hu Deloi, so implying they're not allowed to use it to buy Svarim, HaTorah B'Torah Shapir Dami, implying, but they can use the money to buy another Sefer Torah. So that would show that you could. The answer is the Gemara says, that's not a proof. Masnissin Dieved. The Mishnah is talking about B'Dieved. They sold the Sefer Torah. What are they allowed and not allowed to do with the money? Our question is, are they lachatchila allowed to sell their old sefer Torah in order to buy a new one? You can't see that one way or the other from the Mishnah. Tashma, let's try to bring another proof. A braisa says, gerlin sefer Torah b'mitpachas chumashin. You're allowed to roll up a sefer Torah in the mitpachas, in the mantle that's usually used for chumashim. So you have, in other words, a mantle that previously was used for a chumash. You're allowed now to use it for a sefer Torah. B'chumashin b'mitpachas neviyim uksuvim. You're allowed to wrap up chumashim using the mantle that you used for neviim or kibbutz of neviim uksuvim, avolay neviim uksuvim mepachas chumashim, but not the other way around. You can't wrap up neviim and uksuvim in wrappings of chumashim because chumashim are on a higher level. Avolay chumashim mepachas sefer Torah, and you can't wrap up a chumash in the mantle of a sefer Torah. Katani mias. Now the bottom line is the braisa had said gerlin sefer Torah mepachas chumashim. The braisa had said you can wrap up a sefer Torah in mepachas, in cloths that were used to previously wrap chumashim, implying mitpachas chumashim ein mitpachas sefer Torah loy, implying that you can't wrap up one sefer Torah in the mantle of a different one. So it sounds like, in other words, you can't even use a mantle from one sefer Torah for another sefer Torah. So how could you be able to sell one sefer Torah in order to buy another? 1 second, you're wondering to yourself, what do you mean? We trade mantlach among sefer Torahs all the time. Hold on. Ema sefer. The Gemara says, on the other hand, look at the next part of the braisa. It said, v'loi chumashin b'mitpachas sefer Torah. It said, you can't wrap up chumashim in cloths that are used to wrap up a sefer Torah because you're going down in kedusha. Ha-torah b'torah shapir dami, implying that you could wrap up one sefer Torah in another sefer Torah's mantle. So abedabba, that would show that you could. And in that case, you could also sell one sefer Torah to buy another. The Gemara says, okay, elam ha-holak al-mishma mino. You can't prove anything from this braisa. There's obviously something inexact in this braisa. There's something in which it's not being medayik, and we don't know what it is. So Lamai says, as far as wrapping one sefer Torah in a mantle of another, we don't have a problem with it. But we still haven't answered the question yet about selling one sefer Torah to buy another. So wait. So Toshma, the Gemara says, let's try to bring another proof. Manichin Sefer Torah al Gabi Torah, you're allowed to put one Sefer Torah on top of another one. V'Torah al Gabi Chumashin, you're also allowed to put a Sefer Torah on top of Chumashin. V'Chumashin al Gabi Nevi'im Uksuvim, you're allowed to put Chumashin on top of Nevi'im and Uksuvim. Ava loy Nevi'im Uksuvim al Gabi Chumashin, but not the other way around, Nevi'im Uksuvim on top of Chumashin. V'loy Chumashin al Gabi Torah, and you can't put a Chumash on top of a Sefer Torah. So the fact that you can put one Sefer Torah on top of another means, by the same token, we should assume that you're allowed to sell one Sefer Torah in order to buy another. The Gemara says, Hanocha Kamrit. You're trying to bring a proof from putting Sfarim down. Shiny Hanocha, Delay Efshir. Listen, when it comes to putting them down, you could say the reason you're allowed to is because there's no alternative. Where else? Sometimes you have to put it one Sefer Torah on top of another. De'iloi Temahochi. After all, if you weren't going to say it like that, you would have to ask yourself, never mind putting one Sefer Torah on top of another. Michra Hechi Karchinan, how are you ever allowed to roll up a Sefer Torah? V'hoka Yosef Dapa Achavre, don't you have one page, one column of the Sefer Torah is lying on top of another one? So obviously, Ela Kivin Delay Efshar Shari, obviously the answer is there's no alternative, so therefore it's allowed. Hochanami Kivin Delay Efshar Shari, the same way you could say, when you're putting one Sefer Torah on top of another, you're talking about where you don't have any room and therefore you have to necessarily put one on top of the other. Okay. That doesn't show no proof that because of that, that you would be allowed to sell one Sefer Torah to buy another. By the way, as far as this matter of putting Sfarim on top of another, so this is where we get the halachas that we have. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan says, actually, the Aruch HaShulchan says that all of this discussion is only talking about handwritten Sfarim. He says printed Sfarim don't have that same degree of Kedusha, and he says you would, in fact, be allowed to put any printed Sefer on top of any other. So even, for example, let's say a Siddur on top of a Chumash. On the other hand, most of the other posts can disagree with the Aruch HaShulchan on that, and that's why we have the hierarchy that we're familiar with, that you can put most Sfarim on top of each other. You put Nevi'im and Ksuvim are considered on an equal level for that purpose, and you can put any one of them on top of any other, and Chumashim go on top. And you don't put anything else on top of a Chumash except, as we're saying, a Sefer Torah.
How about the Siddur?
The fact that the Poskim do say when they're all bound together in one volume, then it's different. For example, the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that you're allowed to have one huge scroll of Torah and Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So some of the Mefarshim say there could conceivably be a problem with that. And therefore they say what you would have to do is you would have to keep that scroll as much as possible rolled to the end. That way the Sefer Torah part is on the outside of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim part. But most of the other Mefarshim say that there's no problem with that because that's the derech. When you have one scroll, then you're going to have some parts on top of another. So it's not a problem. So that answers the question, for example, about a Siddur that has Tillim in the back, for example. So there's no problem of the pages of a Siddur being on top of the Tillim. By the same token, also, they talk about, are you allowed to print a one-volume Tanakh? On the face of it, fine, you have the Torah at the beginning, but when you're opening the Sefer and you're using it, at times you're going to have pages of Nevi'im and Ksuvim are going to be on top of Chumash. Again, most of the posts can say that's not a big deal because that's the normal way of using it, and in a certain sense, you could even say that in that case, the Nevi'im and Ksuvim are serving as like a shomer, like a guard, like they're helping protect the pages of the Torah. But when it's separate volumes, then not. Then you can't put anything on top of a chumash. There is also something that the chassidim have a minhag not to put anything on top of a tanya, because tanya after all is Torah shemachsav of Torah chassidus. So even a chumash, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I forgot to mention, by the way, before when we were talking about boxes and things for Sfarim, the Poskim do point out that, for example, bookshelves are not necessarily, we talked about things that are used to protect the Sfarim rather than as honor to them. Bookshelves are in that category, the fact that most of the Sfarim on the bookshelves are bound in their own covers. So therefore, like in a certain sense, the bookshelf is only a tashmish to Kedusha, and therefore it doesn't have the same degree of Kedusha. When a bookshelf that you can't use for Sfarim anymore wears out, you're allowed to use it for other things. There is also a point, actually, that many times we say there's a certain implicit tnai. When you put up a bookshelf, there's a certain tnai involved that you can put other things on it as well. And therefore, that also makes it mutter to put other things on it and to use it for other purposes when you don't need it for Sfarim anymore.
Or tonight you're going to throw it out. You can't keep it forever.
Right, that's okay. So anyway, so we're still in the discussion. So Toshma, to Amar Rav Babachana Amar Rabbi Yechin, Meshum Rav Shimon Gamliel, we say Rav Babachana says, Lo Yimka Adam Sefer Torah Yashan Lekach Bechadosh. You're not allowed to sell an old Sefer Torah in order to buy a new one. So there's our answer. The Gemara says, that's not a proof. Hosim Meshum Pshiosa. Because there, We're talking about there where you don't have the new Sefer Torah yet, so you may get careless. They sold the other, they sold the other Sefer Torah. The new Sefer Torah is not ready yet. Meanwhile, they may spend the money on something else, and then they don't have a Torah at all. So that's not a proof. That case, sure. Ki kamrinan, what we're asking about, the other Sefer Torah is already written. It's all ready to be bought from the Sefer. All you need is the money. So now you want to know, can you sell an old Sefer Torah in order to raise money for the new one? My. So what's the din? Tashma, let's try to bring another proof. To Amar Abyechan Meshum Rav Meir, Ein Moichlin Sefer Torah, Ela Lumad Torah Valisa Isha. You're not allowed to sell a Sefer Torah only in order to use the money to learn Torah. Now that can mean in order to support yourself while you're learning Torah, Rashi says. It can also mean, I think the Rambam says, that it means to pay Schar Limud for learning Torah, or Valisa Isha, or in order to have money to get married. So Shmamina Torah, Batorah, Shapir Dummy. So you see from that, you're allowed to sell one Sefer Torah to buy another one, because what are you getting the new one for? You're Bepashtus in order to learn from it. The answer is not necessarily. Duma Shiny Limud, Shal Limud maybe the day Maisa. Maybe it's different when you're selling a Sefer Torah in order to be able to learn Torah, because as we know, Talmud Torah is a tremendous thing because it leads to Maisa. So therefore, so you could say that that's different than a Sefer Torah, which they're just using for laning and shul, which is not really learning Torah to the same degree. Isha Nami, and we could say the reason also, by the way, Avraham Moshe, this might answer your question also, we were saying before, that Talmud Torah connected Kulon, fine, but on the other hand, we say that Talmud may be the day Maisa. So in that case, maybe the Maisa, including davening, in a certain sense, could be considered greater. Anyway, Isha Nami, when it comes to getting married, also we can say that's a very important reason, because after all, the Pasuk says Hashem didn't create the world for nothingness. He made it in order to be settled. So therefore, getting married is a very important mitzvah. It's the purpose for which the Eibishter put us in the world in the first place. So therefore, you could say that, yeah, Abel Torah, B'Torah Loi. But not necessarily, maybe still you can't sell one Sefer Torah in order to buy another one. So still no proof yet. So the Gemara says, Tanarabbanan, the Gemara says, we learn in a Braisa, lo yimko adam sefer Torah af bishen et sarif. A person should not sell a sefer Torah even though he doesn't need it, because let's say Rashi says he has another one. Yes, Rakein, Omer Abshimen Gamliel. The Abshimen Gamliel says, beyond that, afilo ein lo yimai yoichal, even if a person doesn't have what to eat, he doesn't have money, he doesn't have food, umachar sefer Torah, and he sells a sefer Torah in order to have money for food, or he sells his daughter as an omer hevriya, where we know the Torah tells us in Parashas Mishpatim that he could, but still, he will never see a simin bracha from that money. Now, the Gemara has not really answered the question, though. Lamaisa, can you sell an old sefer Torah to buy a new one? So here you actually have a machlokas between the Shach and the Taz about it. The Shach says, since the Gemara has not concluded it, we have to be machmir with a suffix. Fine, it's a suffix d'rabbanan, but still, it's a suffix involving the covered of the Torah, and therefore you have to be machmir. On the other hand, the Taz says, maybe not. The Reb Moshe has in one of his Chuvas, he says we should be machmir like the Shach. On the other hand, there are some exceptions to that. First of all, Tosfos in Bava Basra, which is referenced here on the side, says that also they could sell a Sefer Torah for Pidyon Shvuyim. Because Tosfos says, the Gemara didn't mention over here, because it's obvious. If he's saying that you can sell a Sefer Torah in order to learn Torah or in order to get married, how much more so Pidyon Shvuyim, which is a greater mitzvah than everything, than almost anything else. On the other hand, the Rambam seems to disagree with that. And Hagoyis Maimonius asks on the Rambam how he could disagree. So for Pidyon Shvuyim is not necessarily so simple. There you have a machlokas on that. Where the old Sefer Torah was possible, then Rav Moshe writes in one of his Chuvas that you are allowed to sell it in order to buy a new one, because anyway, can't use it for laning.
You can fix it, then it doesn't.
If you can fix it, fine. Sometimes you have a possible Sefer Torah which can't be fixed. Think of, for example, here's an example. You know that Sefer Torah that they wrote that Hatzalah sponsored a couple of years ago at the beginning of Corona, the Sefer Torah for protection. So then you have a few months ago during the hurricane where places were flooded all over the place, and one of those Sefer Torah, unfortunately, was badly damaged by water. So it wasn't fixable anymore. So now that they can't sell anymore, fine. I mean, nobody's gonna buy it. But let's say, for example, it was damaged enough that it's not really possible to fix it. But on the other hand, So
changing the whole, I guess the whole thing was wet.
So the whole thing was wet. So yeah, they would have had to rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's how I'm thinking.
Yeah. So right. So So in general, we say that you shouldn't. On the other hand, again, there are details about it. When it's a sefer Torah that belongs to an individual, then the poskim are a little more makel on it, even though we're saying over here in the Gemara, ein roya sim bracha lo'olam, fine, but you are allowed to, they say, especially because when a person himself has a sefer Torah, it's almost like there's an implicit t'nai in it, maybe, like we were talking before about t'noyim, that he could sell it if need be. Definitely, they say that if, for example, a person, let's say, received a sefer Torah in payment of a debt or something, then for sure he's allowed to resell it because he didn't himself buy it at all. So there are different details about these things that have to be checked. That have to be checked with a rav if you're in that situation where you want to sell a sefer Torah, then you check with a rav about the details.
I thought they had a sharper and a nicer, newer, a better, long lasting sefer Torah.
So according to the Taz, it would be fine. According to the Shach, not necessarily. Yeah.
Now the English of Bracha, I think it was only if you sell your daughter for
no. No, we said both. Macha sefer Torah or bita. We're saying both. Yeah. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, v'chein b'moisrei, we said the same dinim apply to the leftovers, meaning, in other words, we said, let's say, for example, they sold Sfarim and they used the money to buy a Sefer Torah, and now they have some of the money left over. They also can't use that to downgrade in Kedusha. They have to go start putting that money for a higher level of Kedusha. So the Gemara says, Omar Rava, lo shanu ela shemachru v'hoisiru. That's only talking about when they had an item of Kedusha, which they sold, and now they have money left over because they didn't need all the money for the new thing. But if to begin with, they collected money for the tzibur, let's say, for example, to buy a sefer Torah, and there's money left over that they didn't need towards the sefer Torah, mutter, then they're allowed to use it for a lower level of kedusha, because after all, it wasn't yet used for a higher level of kedusha. It was only collected for that purpose. Abaya says, what do you mean? Abraisa says, when is this talking about the dinim of our Mishnah that you can only go up in Kedusha, not down, only if they didn't make a Tanai? Abel Hisnu, but the Braisa says if they did make a Tanai, that we want to be able to use the money, the leftover money for something else, afilu the duchsusia mutter, then you're allowed to use that leftover money even for duchsusia, which we'll explain soon in the Gemara what that means. So Abaya says, hey, chidami. Now you have to think, what's the scenario that the Braisa is talking about? Are we talking about, let's say, where they already had Sfarim and sold them, and now we said they used most of the money for a Sefer Torah, and now they have leftover? What would it help if they made a Tanai? The Mishnah said they have to go up in Kedusha. The fact is, you had an item that had Kedusha, you transferred the Kedusha onto the money, how can you now go and use the money for something else, even with a Tanai? Evidently, we have to be talking about where they collected money and there's leftover money afterwards. Time of hisnu, and so the Braisa is implying only because they made a Tanai is it mutter, holoi hisnu loi, and implying that if they didn't make a Tanai, then not. So what are you telling me, Rava, that even without a Tanai, you're allowed to use the leftover collected money for whatever you want? The answer is loi. No, because the Braisa could actually be talking about the case where they sold the Sfarim or whatever it is and have money left over. So the Braisa means, when we talk about Tanai, means we're talking about when the Shiva Tuvei Ir that we talked about previously in the Gemara, the seven people who are responsible for affairs of the Tzibur, they're the ones, they're like the community representatives. So they act on behalf of the Tzibur. So if they didn't make a Tanai, the Maimed Anshe Ir, in the presence of the people of the city, then you can't use the leftover money for anything you want. Aval Hisna Shuvit Shiva Tuvei Ir, Maimed Anshe Ir, but if they made such a Tanai, when they sold the Sfarim or the Teva or what have you, then afilu l'duchsusya nami motor. Then it would be allowed to use it even for duchsusya. In other words, just like we said before, that for example, when they sell the shul, we said that if they sell it shiva tovei ir b'maimed an she'ir, then we said they were allowed to even use the money to buy beer, to go and make and drink beer. So the same way, because now the whole tzibur agreed to it, we talk about a machloikus of the Ramban and the Ran, what the mechanism is, how that works, but in any case, it does work. So the same way, the Braisa over here could be talking about that. Not necessarily is it talking anything about where they collected money and have left over. There you could say you don't even need it tonight, like Rava says. So now, what is duchsus? So Abaya says to one of the chachamim who used to arrange braises in front of Rav Sheches. So in those times, they didn't have Mishnayos and braises were written down yet. Okay, maybe the Mishnah was written, but the braises certainly weren't. So you had people whose job was to repeat braises in the Batei Medrash, and then they would discuss them. So he used to do that. So Abaye asked him, Mish mi alach mi Rav Sheshes, my Duch Susia. Have you heard anything from Rav Sheshes about what Duch Susia is? Omalei, so he tells him, Hochi Amar Rav Sheshes, Parsha de Mosa. It means the horsemen of the city, which means Rashi says, let's say, for example, the people of the city sometimes need something from the mayor or the nobleman or whatever who owns the city. So he doesn't necessarily live in the city itself. He lives out of town. So they need to hire somebody to ride on a horse to go tell him what they need in the city. So that's called Parsha Namasa, and that's what's called the Braisa Duch Susia. So we're saying that if they made such a tnai, then they were allowed to use the money even for that. A different explanation of Parsha Namasa is that it means a horseman who rides around the city to guard it. Like they have mounted guards around the city to protect it.
Sell it in order to pay him or hire him?
To pay him or hire him, that's what we're saying, yeah.
So
Parsha
Masa and Dussusia
is the same thing. So Dussusia, I guess, is a Greek or Latin or something word for it. And Parsha Masa is what they called it in Aramaic. It could be. I mean, Duch means a place. You find in some places where the word Duch in the Gemara, where Duch means a place, Susia is like Sus, a horse. So maybe it means like a place, like the person whose job it is to ride on the horse. I don't know. Amar Abaye says, you learn a hurrah from this story. If a young Talmid Chacham hears something while he's learning, he doesn't know what it means. Like in this case, we didn't know what the word Duch Susia means. What he should do is ask, even he can ask somebody who regularly is in front of the Chacham. It's impossible that he won't at some point have heard it from a great person. In other words, this Hahumin Abonan, Davin Masadim Asnissa, is not necessarily a great Talmid Chacham, but he was always in Rav Sheshes' Beis Medrash, and therefore he was able to hear the explanation of this, even though he himself is not much of a Talmid Chacham. So the same way, Rabbi says, you learn from this, Ahura, for life, that make sure to ask these things by people who are regular in the Beis Medrash, they're likely to pick up such things just by overhearing.
Right,
but the point is, in other words, especially just even though they're not sitting and learning it in the Beis Medrash, they just they overhear it. That itself is a great thing. Okay. Another din in this connection, maybe we'll bring this in because before we brought something from Rabbi Yechon and then Emre Meir, and now we'll. So we are, but more likely it's because the actual topic that we're going to talk about itself has to do with the money of that from one city, what we do with it in that city versus another city. That as far as tzedakah, bnei ha'ir shahochol le'ir acheres, if people from one city went to a different city, uposku alein tzedakah, and the gaboi tzedakah in that other city told them to give a certain amount of tzedakah, noisnin, so they give it there to the gaboi tzedakah. They don't say, because you don't want to be choshed them, that they said that they pledged that they're going to give a certain amount and they're not giving it. So they give it there in that city to the gaboi tzedakah. Uchshein boyin, when they come back to their town, mevi'in oseiman, they can take that money back from the gaboi tzedakah and take it with them, or mefarnes and ba'aniyei iron, and they can use it to support the poor people in their own city. 30
days.
Yeah. So if they were in the other town for less than 30 days. Tani nami hachi bnei yir shalchol le'racheres or poskal and tzedakah noisnin or shein boin mevi'in oseiman. On the other hand, the braisa continues. That's only when you have a bunch of people. On the other hand, if it was one individual person or less than 10 people, the post can say, who went to a different city or poskwal of tzedakah, and they got from him a pledge for tzedakah over there, then it does have to be given to the people of that, to the poor people of that city, because it's one thing when you have 10 or more people, you can say they're considered like a miniature city in itself, and therefore like they have the right to take that money and use it for the poor people of their city. But one individual person or a few individual people, they don't have that right. They're bottled to the people of the other city, and therefore the tzedakah that they pledged goes to the people of that city. So the Gemara gives an example. Rav Huna gozatan nisa. Rav Huna one time declared a fast day, whether it was because they didn't have rain or some other tzara, as we learned about in Masechta Tainis. Ol l'gabei Rav Chana b'chaniloi v'chol b'nei Mosei. Rav Chana b'chaniloi and other people from his town came to to Rav Huna's city. Rav Huna lived in Surah, so they came from some other city to Surah on the day of the Tainis. Romu alai tzedakah, so they demanded from them tzedakah. They got from them pledges for tzedakah. The Yavu, and so they gave it to the Gaboi tzedakah, like we said. Ki bolame, say now when Rav Huna bar Haniloi and the rest of the Chachamim are getting ready to leave, Omrulei, they said to Rav Huna, nois v'lon mar, Rebbe, please give us back that money, v'nezel on a fire respond, yemosin, and we're going to go use it for the poor people of our city. Like we just said, they could do that because they're more than 10 people. Omrulehu, but Rav Huna says, this is a different case. Tanena, we said before, we learned in a braisa, b'medron amurim, she'en shom chever ir, only if that city where they pledged the tzedakah does not have a chever ir. Rashi says that chever ir means the rov of the city. A tamid chacham hamisasik b'tzorchei tzibur. A tamid chacham who's occupying himself with the affairs of the community and like he's responsible for everything that goes on in the city. There's a different other explanation that some of the Shonim have that chever ir means like a group of gaboi tzedakah, as opposed to like you have like you can have a case where everybody gives their tzedakah on their own versus where you have a where you have like kol chabad or something where they have like a central foundation for tzedakah where people give through that. Avo yesham chever ir, but the Braisa continues, if there is a chever ir, tinosim chever ir, then it has to be given to the chever ir because he is responsible for everything in the city. He or that group of gaboi tzedakah or whatever is responsible for everything that's in the city. And therefore, in other words, when you pledge the tzedakah, you pledged it al das that he can do with it what he sees fit. So therefore, you don't have the right to take it back to your city and use it for your own ending. And Rav Huna tells them, how much more so in this case, where the Aniyim here in Surah, as well as in the other town that you came from, are all depending on me, because Surah was the big city in the area, and all the Aniyim, even in the smaller villages nearby, all depended on him. So therefore, Rav Huna says, in that case, you don't have the right to take it and give it at your own discretion to the Aniyim of your place. You leave it over here with me, and it'll end up benefiting them as well. But especially because I'm the Chever here. Okay. Mishnah says,
that's something he just created.
He quoted a braisa.
But they didn't know the braisa
So it happens all the time. It happens all the time that the Gemara brings in braisas not all the Amoroim are expected to know all the braisas. The Amoroim have to know all the Mishnayos. They don't necessarily know all the braisas, which is why we just said that you had people whose job was Masader Masnisa to arrange the braisas in the Batei Medrash. Yeah. So they didn't know it, but obviously they know that Rav Huna is not just making up a braisa, and he's not just making up a braisa, he's quoting them a braisa. In fact, the expression he uses is interesting. The expression he used was Taneina, we have learned a braisa, which means it may even mean it's something he tells them, you should have been expected to know this braisa. But whatever the case, whether they did or they didn't, the point is they knew it now.
They were 30 days or less.
Doesn't matter, apparently, whether they were there 30 days or less, apparently, yeah.
Those days it wasn't valid, no.
Okay. The Mishnah says, "Ein mochrinas sharabim leyochid." When you have a shul, that or any of the other things that we said in the previous Mishnah, the teva, the svarim, etc., you're not allowed to sell one that belonged to the rabbim to a yochid, to an individual. Because you're taking it down from its degree of kedusha, it was used by the rabbim, and now it's only used only by a yochid. Divrei Rav Meir, that's what Rav Meir said. Says, or Rabbi Yehuda, it says on the side, Omru Loi, the Chacham told him, Im Kain, if you're going to learn like that, Afloime, Irdolel, Irtana, then you wouldn't be allowed to sell it, for example, from a big city to a small city either, because you have fewer people using it now, and obviously you don't say that. So therefore, there's no problem selling it to a Yochid. So the Gemara says, Shapir Kamil, Rabbanu, Rabbanu, Meir, Nu, don't the Chacham have a valid point? Why does Rabbanu distinguish between a Rabbim and Yochid versus a larger Rabbim and smaller Rabbim? So Rav Meir would answer to that, Meir Gdol Le'irktana, because when you're going from a big city to a small city, fine, Me'ikra Kadisha V'Hashinami Kadisha, fine, you still have the same degree of Kedusha, you're still saying Dovash of Kedusha, you're still saying things with a minion over there. Me'ir Rabin Le'yochid like a Kedusha. But when you go from Rabin to Yochid, you're not going to be saying Dvorim Shem Kedusha over there anymore. V'Rabbanan, what did the Rabbanan answer to that? They answer, E'ikla Mechash, if you're going to be concerned about it, Kihai Gavna Nami Ikla Mechash, then you should be concerned about that also, between many and fewer. Because after all, Mishum Beroivam Hadras Melech, the more people in davening, the more people giving honor to Hashem together, the greater it is. And yet it doesn't matter. The fact is, Dvorim Shebekdusha or Dvorim Shebekdusha. So therefore, it doesn't really matter, even when you're selling to a Yochid, So it doesn't matter. You're allowed to use it. The next Mishnah is going to say there are certain purposes that you're not allowed to use the shul building for, but anything else, as long as he's still using it as a place of Kedusha, then it doesn't matter. Then it doesn't matter, even though now there's not necessarily going to be a regular minion there, let's say.
So there's some of the sfarim that belong to the Beis Medrash, you're selling to a private person.
So you're selling to a private person. So we're saying that's fine.
Still be learned, but
they're still going to be learned. They're going to be learned by fewer people, right? That's what we're saying.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's what they're The Mishnah continues, Ein Mokrin Beis HaKnesses El Al Tnai. Now you're only allowed to sell a shul with a Tnai, Shem Yutsu Yachziruhu, that if the Tzibur wants it, they're going to be able to get it back. Dibir Amei. That's what Rameir says. So even when you're selling from Rabim to Rabim, Rameir says to be Zoyan to sell it permanently, like as if we don't need it, as if like we don't care for it. Now we learned on Chavav Amad Beis that you had a case over there. We said that that you're not allowed to lend out a shul, you're not allowed to mortgage a shul. So Tosfos had said over there that Rameir, that again, you have the difference between Rabim to Rabim. When we say you're not allowed to mortgage it or rent it, it means to a yachid. So the mayor says you're not even allowed to sell it to a yachid. So then you're also not allowed to rent it or mortgage it to a yachid. But to a rabbin would be fine, he said. Yeah. Okay. So divrei Reb Meir, that's what the mayor says. You have to sell a shul only al tanai. The chum say you can sell a shul permanently. And even to a yachid, like they said in the previous Mishnah, chutz me'abod varim, with the exception of you're not allowed to sell where the building is going to be used for any of the following four things. L'merchatz, where it's going to be used as a bathhouse, or l'burski, or as a tannery, which smells really bad, l'tvila, or a place where they're going to table, or l'beis hamayim, or for a beis hamayim, which means it actually says two possibilities. A laundry, one is that it means a laundry, a second is that it means a place where they're going to urinate. So those, to urinate, to fish.
But the tefillah, which should be a whole thing, the mikvah.
No, so, but nevertheless, it's still people get undressed in there. So now, it is true, actually, when you have, for example, so I think Ramosha talks about in one of his truvas, that fine, for example, where you have no alternative, you need a mikvah for the women, and the halacha is that even you're allowed to sell a shul in order to build a mikvah for the women, that's a valid reason to, in fact, the building a mikvah takes precedence, so then maybe we would say that, yes, then maybe you could sell it, then maybe you could sell it for that, but not otherwise. If you have an alternative, then you should.
Yeah, for a church.
For churches, it's even more of a bizarre, yeah, so... Rabbi Yehuda says, what you can do is you can sell the place as a chotzer, but mashiyur tzayasa, and then the buyer can do whatever he wants with it, because then, in other words, the kedusha is completely taken off from it, and you can do whatever you want with it. Definitely, though, the post can say that if, for example, the person who buys it is going to be tearing down the building and building a new one, then for sure you're allowed to use that place for whatever is necessary. So the Gemara asks, now, according to Rav Meir, that you're making a tnai, so in other words, at any time you can undo the sale and refund the money. The problem is, meanwhile, how is the guy who bought it allowed to live there? How have you le ribis? Don't you have a problem of ribis? You paid, for example, $1 million for this building. You're living in it now. Eventually, when they undo the sale, you're going to be returning them their $1 million. Meanwhile, you've been living in there for free. So in effect, you're getting a benefit for the fact that you lent them money.
The shul got the benefit?
The tzibur got the benefit, right? They got the $1 million. Meanwhile, though, the guy who bought it is living over there. So don't you have a problem of ribis? The answer is, Amar Rav Yechanan, Rav Meir b'shittas Rav Yehuda. Rav Meir, in this particular detail, is following the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, the Omer Tzad Echad B'Ribis Mutter, who says when you have one-sided ribis, then it's mutter. Now, one-sided ribis means, in other words, it's not necessarily going to be ribis because they might end up buying back the place. They might not. Now, Tosfos points out, you do have cases in Bava Metzia, in Ezer Neshech, which is the whole perek that talks about the details of ribis. You have many cases over there where you have only one possibility, and we say it is considered ribis, at least in Abana. The difference is, Tosfos says that over here there wasn't even a loan in the first place. When you have something similar to a loan, like when you have a loan or something similar to a loan, and you have tzad echad, then you have a problem. But here, there's no loan at all. It's done as a sale. Implicitly, it's going to end up being a loan if it turns out that they buy back the place, and it turns out that the guy had in effect only borrowed it for a period of time. since it wasn't done as a loan in the first place, and it's only tzad echad, and it's only tzad echad, then Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter.
And this Libus question is on the Rab, is on the shul, on the Rabban?
Is on the person who's living there. That we sold him the building. So he, the tzibur sold him the building. Now he's living there. Eventually, if he gives back the place and they give him back the money, then it comes out in effect that the money was only a loan for a period of time. And meanwhile, he was living there for free.
He was living free, but he took care of the maintenance of the place.
Not necessarily did he. There wasn't necessarily any maintenance there.
Let's say there was no maintenance.
Responsibility. Right. Okay, but again, the answer is, since there wasn't an actual loan in the first place, it was structured as a sale, and it's only tzad echad, it's not necessarily that there's going to be ribis involved, Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter, Rabbi Meir is following that sheet. Yeah, detanya, as in fact we learn in a braisa. Haresha hoya noshe b'chaveri moneh, suppose that a person is owed a money by somebody else. The Ruvain previously lent Shimon a money, 100 zuz, and so Shimon says to Ruvain, I'm making my field is going to be a potential sale to you, meaning I'm mortgaging my field to the loan that if I don't pay back the loan by such and such a date, then you get this field. So if the seller continues to eat the payrus of the field during the life of the loan, then it's mutter, because then there's no ribis at all. Because then obviously, the moicher continues to eat the payrus. He's not giving anything extra to the lekeach. Lekeach eichel payrus also. But if the buyer eats the payrus, then it's also. Because now, if he does end up paying back the loan, then it comes out that the lekeach got something extra. He gets back his money as well as he has the food that he ate for free. Rabbi Yehuda, I'm after the lekeach eichel payrus mutter. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says it's mutter even if the lekeach is eating payrus. And the Omer of Yehuda, and Rabbi Yehuda says, I'll bring you a proof. It happened with Baisus ben Zunan, who was a balabas in the time, he was a rich balabas in the times of Tanoim. We find in various places in Shas, it mentions things that he did. So he wasn't one of the Chachamim, but he was closely associated with the Chachamim. And we often find the Gemara often brings proofs from what he did, because whenever he did something, he always made sure to ask a Shaila and follow what the Chachamim said. So Sha'asa Sadeo Mecher, Al Pir of Elazar ben Azariah, he did that. He arranged for a Mecher of his field, according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. In other words, he asked Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to tell him what to do in this, that there shouldn't be a problem of ribis. And the Lekeach was eating the Peiris. So you see, there's no problem.
So he sold the field.
So in other words, so let's say, for example, Baisus had borrowed money from somebody else. He tells somebody else, if I don't pay you back by such and such a time, then this field of mine, you'll be able to keep it. Now, during the time, during the life of the loan, the lekeach, Rabbi Yehuda is saying, was eating the payrus. The other guy, not Baisus, but the other guy, was eating the payrus. And there's obviously no problem. So you see that it's allowed. Amru loy, but the Chachamim said to Rabbi Yehuda, Misham Raya, you're bringing a proof from there. Meicher echel payrus, how you're a lekeach. The Meicher, in our scenario, Baisus himself continued to eat the payrus from that field during the time of the loan, not the Lekeach. Now, how are they arguing on Metzius? So one possibility is that Rabbi Yehuda did not know who was eating the payrus, but he assumed usually when they make such arrangements, usually the Lekeach is the one who's eating the payrus. So in this case, he assumed that's how it was, and the Chachamim are telling him no. As a matter of fact, in this case, it was Meicher.
Saying that the day that the loan was up and he didn't pay, that's when he can take.
That's when he takes the field, right? My benayu. So what's the actual? What's the point of the machlokas between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda? Why does Rabbi Yehuda allow it and the Chachamim not? Tzad echa beribis ikka benayu. Because they're arguing about this case of tzad echa beribis. Mar sava tzad echa beribis mutter. So Rabbi Yehuda holds it's allowed because again. It's not necessarily that there's going to be a ribis. If he ends up paying off the loan, then there's not going to be a ribis at all. Therefore, Rabbi Yehuda doesn't consider that to be ribis. Rabbi Nachmanu explains it differently. That the point is the usual ribis involves that both sides, the loive is giving ribis, the malve is receiving it. Here, you really only have that one side is that one side has in other words, Rabbi Hanan explains relative to the lekeach, if he ends up paying off the field, then you have a problem of ribis. But relative to the moicher, the moicher does not necessarily have to pay off the loan. He could default on the loan and then the field ends up going to the other guy. He can't force the situation. Therefore, there may never be ribis at all. That's how Rabbi Chanan explains tzadech beribis. Anyway, so mar savat tzadech beribis motor, umar savat tzadech beribis also. So that's the machlokes Rabbi Yehuda and the Chacham. So therefore, Rabbi Meir in our Mishnah is following the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that tzadech beribis is motor. So again, when you're selling the shul, not necessarily is the tzibur going to be buying it back. So therefore, it's only one possibility that there's going to be ribis, not another one. Or according to Rabbi Chanan, again, the point is that only the moicher, that only the lekeach can force the issue, the moicher can't. Therefore, even when you look at it from the point of view of the two parties, only one of them is even talking about a potential of ribis. So therefore, the mayor would hold, like Rabbi Yehuda, that it's mutter. Rava gives a different explanation of the machlokas Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim. The kula amat tzadech beribis aser. You could answer instead that both the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda agree that tzadech beribis is aser, but v'hocha ribis amanas lahachzir ikke benayu. The nafkamina between them would be where there's ribis, but he's going to return it. So in other words, let's say in the case of the shul, yeah, if they do buy it back, then he's going to pay them rent for the time that he was living. So Mar Sava Ribis Amanas Lahasa Mutter, Mar Sava Osir. So therefore the mayor and Rabbi Yehuda would say it's allowed, the Chachamim would say it's not allowed. Okay, we said in the mission of a Chachamim and Merchinais and Mimkar Urban Fuller, the Chachamim said you can sell the shul permanently. You don't have to make a Tanai like Rabbi Meir says. But we said you're not allowed to sell it for any of the four things that we mentioned in the Mishnah. As a bathhouse, as a cannery, as a mikveh, or a beis hamayim, where again, Nashi had two explanations what beis hamayim is. So the Gemara mentions in this connection a din that's going to tie back to what we said. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel Mutar La'Adam La'Hashdin Mayim B'Seich Dalat Amos Shel Tefila. A person is allowed to urinate within four amos of a place where he davened. In other words, what we mean is, in other words, if a person daven, let's say, for example, a person daven, you have to remember, in those days, they didn't have bathrooms in their houses. So let's say, for example, a person davens in their house. So afterwards, they would be allowed to go and urinate within four amos of the spot where they stood in order to daven. We don't say that place, once he davened there, has kedusha forever, and therefore that he can't. Amr Rabbi Yosef, Ma'ika Mash Malan. So Rabbi Yosef says, what's the Chiddush? Tanena. We learned in our Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda, Amr Merchun Oysel Shum Chotzer, that Rabbi Yehuda says you're allowed to sell a shul as a Chotzer, the Lekeach Mashi Yirtze Yasa, and the Lekeach will do with the property whatever he wants, meaning that he's going to be even allowed, according to Rabbi Yehuda, to use it for one of these four things. Va'afilu Rabbanon like Ka'amri Elabesa Knesses to Kriya Kushte. Even the Chachamim who disagree are only talking about a shul, which has a permanent degree of kedusha. Abel dalan amos to like via kedusha sayu, but the four amos within you daven in your living room, that place doesn't have any particular kedusha. Loi, so obviously not. So what's the chiddush? Of course you should be allowed to. So the Gemara says. So the Gemara continues. Toni Tana kameid Rav Nachman, a Tana taught a brisa in front of Rav Nachman. Hamispalo mach dalan amos umashdin. When a person daven, he has to move away four amos from there, and then he can urinate. And vice versa. If a person urinated, he has to move at least four amos away from there in order to daven. Omale, so Rav Nachman says, I don't understand. I understand that if the urination came first, you have to move away four amos and daven. Tanena, because we learn in the Mishnah. How far away do you have to be from Meiraglayim or from Tsoya for Dalet Amos in order to daven? You need to be four amos away. Really, by the way, technically what it is you need to be four amos away from where the smell ends. So we're talking about, for example, Meiraglayim that have no smell, then fine, you just need four amos. If they have an actual odor, then you need to move further away. Or whatever. So it has an odor, right? Ella, but Rav Nachman says, how can you be saying in your Braisa, Hamispalo Mach Dal Amos Umashtin? You're saying that if a person daven in a certain place, then you have to move four amos away and only then you can urinate. Lumally, why would you need that? Then in that case, all the alleyways in Nahar Dah are going to have kedusha, because at one time or another, people stand there and daven, and you're not going to say that. So what does it mean? Tony, sort of Nachman, tells the Tana what you should learn in your Braisa, not that Marfik, not that you have to move away for Amos, but Yat Yish, that after you finish davening, you should wait the time, the amount of time that it takes to walk for Amos, and then if you have to urinate, then you do that.
You don't have to move away.
So the Gemara says, Bishleim, so then that, so both parts of the Braisa should be saying that. So the Gemara says, Bishleim Mashtin Yisha Kudei Hiloch Dalad Amos. Okay, so I can understand then after a person urinated, he should wait a distance of at least 4 amos before he starts davening. I can understand. Bishum Nitzoytzis, the reason is because of drops of urine that fell on his clothing, that that at least they should get absorbed into his clothing before he starts Shmanasra. Elam Spalo Yisha Kudei Hiloch Dalad Amos, Lomali. Why after you daven Shmanasra, why would you need to wait the time of 4 amos before you urinate? And the answer is Amar Ravashi should call Dalad Amos Tfilosi Sdura Bafir. Because for the distance, for the amount of time that it takes to walk 4 amos, which is about 2 or 3 seconds, during that time, a person's tefillah is still arranged in his mouth. His lips are still moving with the words of davening. So therefore, give a couple of seconds after you finish davening to stop saying the words of davening, and then you can go. Okay. So even though you went back 3 steps and all, yeah. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to bring in this connection, since we mentioned this idea of not urinating near where you're davening, or vice versa. So now the Gemara is going to bring where one of the Chachamim said that as a reason why he lived long. And the Gemara is going to bring now several Chachamim where they asked them, in what schus did you live long? And each of them mentions different things that they did. So Zalfon Simon, this is a Simon for the names of 4 Chachamim. So number one, Shalu Talmidim Eser Zakai Bameher Rafti Yamin. Reb Zakai's Talmidim asked him, in what zchus did you live long? But Pashtus, this is not Zakai as in like father of Reb Yechanan Zakai. This is somebody later. Because Reb Yechanan is never called Reb Yechanan Ben Reb Zakai. So Pashtus, his father was not necessarily a Talmid Chacham, but this Reb Zakai is from some later generation. Anyway, so Bameher Rafti Yamin, in what zchus did you live long? So he tells them, in all my life, I never urinated within 4 amos of tefillah, which means, in other words, now here we mean, Tosfos says, we mean the actual distance, even though me'ikar din, you'd be allowed to, as we just said, once you wait the time of 4 amos, then you'd be allowed to, he would be machmir on himself and actually move 4 amos away from the spot where he had davened. So v'loy kinisi shem l'chaverai, I also never called my friends by a nickname. Which means that Tosfos says, now, if it was a derogatory nickname, then that wouldn't be a chumrah. That's me'ikar adin. You're not allowed to. A person who calls another person by a derogatory name, ein lechelek on l'abba. But here we're talking about where there's no gnai even, he wouldn't even do that. And the third thing he says, I was never mevatel kiddush of the day, meaning even if I didn't have wine, I would never just make kiddush on bread or something. I would always have wine for kiddush. So the Gemara tells, he tells himself, Imaz Kena Hoysali, I had an old mother, or Imaz Kena can also mean a grandmother, whatever. Pamachas, one time, we had no money in the house, but she realized that I really want wine for Kiddush. So Machra Kippa Shabarosha, she sold the cap that she wore on her head. Women used to wear on in those times under their tichol or under their shetel, they would wear a kind of cap. So she sold that. Vevia the Kiddush Ayam, and she brought me wine for Kiddush. So in the source of that, Tona, we learn in a Braisa, Kshemesa, when this mother or grandmother of Reb Zakkai passed away, she had gotten richer, and she was so rich, she left for Reb Zakkai as an inheritance, 300 barrels of wine. Kshemeshu, and later on, when Reb Zakkai himself passed away years later, he left for his descendants 3,000 barrels of wine. So Hashem gave them riches in the schus that they were so careful with the mitzvah of kiddush hayom, of making kiddush on wine and not, in fact, Tosfos refers to a Gemara in Shabbos that says exactly that. A person is careful with kiddush hayom, then he has the schus that he'll have barrels upon barrels of wine. So both of them did, but she did it because of him. That's why she had the schus that she left over some, and he was the cause of that mitzvah, because she only did it because she knew he's extra careful with it. Therefore, he had 10 times as much. Yeah.
So the schus of making kiddush on grape juice is less than making it on wine.
No, but Pashtus, when we say wine, and usually when we say wine in Gemara, usually it includes grape juice as well. Practically speaking, they couldn't keep grape juice for very long. They didn't have pasteurization, so it would spoil unless they made it into wine. L'chora, we're talking about grape juice as well. All we mean is as opposed to bread. You are allowed to make Kiddush on bread, but it's a less preferable way of doing it. Pashtus, there is an Indian to use wine because it's more, it's more chosher. So, for example, I have a hard time with a full cup of wine for Kiddush. But so what I do is I use some wine and some grape juice. That way, there's no minimum alcohol content that it has to have in order to be considered wine. So like this, it has alcohol in it. But yeah, obviously, if a person, for example, is a former alcoholic and has to swear off wine, we're not talking about that. Let him make Kiddush on grape juice by all means. Yeah.
How much wine and how much grape juice in proportion?
I don't know. I myself, you can use whatever proportion you want. I guess I don't know. I usually use about one part wine and three, and then two or three parts grape juice. But
I buy less. That's four.
Yeah, you buy a light wine. You buy a 4 or 5% alcohol wine. Yeah, you can do that, do you?
They didn't have money for Kiddush. Did they have money for food?
Apparently, they had money for food, for basic food. It's not for wine. Yeah. Okay.
Earlier, when you said you didn't call anybody by Kinoi, is it Kinoi that? His name is Yosef. You call him Yossi or a Remo? Is that a kinui?
The Pashtus, that's not what we mean by a kinui. The Pashtus, a kinui means more like a nickname for somebody like Shorty or whatever. Or even, okay, we're saying not a shame gnai, but, whatever. Something like a nickname, but not some derogatory, but still. Yeah, let's say that.
But let's say there was a person in Dashba, and then there was everybody understands it's not a gnai.
Okay, but even so, I guess you're exactly, I was still careful about that. Okay. So the Gemara gives another example of somebody who was extra careful with the mitzvah of Kiddush and had a schus because of that. The Gemara says, Rav Huna have osa risa. Rav Huna one time had a risa around his waist. It actually says risa is a kind of grass. So like he made a rope out of grass and was wearing it as a belt around his waist instead of a normal belt. V'koi kameh de Rav. He's standing in front of Rav as a Talmud to learn Torah from him. Amale mai hai. So Rav asked him, why you're wearing a grass belt? Amale, so Rav Huna tells him, lo havale kiddusha. I didn't have wine for kiddush. O mashkante lehem yinoi. So I pawned my belt in order to get money. Vasei be kiddusha. And I went and I used the money to buy wine for kiddush. Amale, so Rav tells him, yehei Rav titum bishiroi. May it be Hashem's will that one day you be covered with silk clothing. So what happened? So many years passed. Rav Huna eventually became rich. Ki ichlal Rabba breid Rav Huna. When Rabba, the son of Rav Huna, was getting married. Now Rav Huna inish gutza. Ki ichlal Rabba breid. When Rabba, his son, years later, was getting married. Now Rav Huna inish gutza haba. Rav Huna was a short person. So gun apuya. He was lying down on a bed there, sometimes someplace in or near the chasna hall. Asyan bnosev kalose. His daughters and his daughters-in-law came into the room. Shochan, they took off the Shadyan Manayu Ale, and they were throwing their clothes on him. He was sleeping on the bed over there, but he was short, so they didn't notice him in the bed. And the stomach was like half dark in there. So they took off their coats, which were made out of silk, and threw them on the bed. Ad itum b'shiroi. So literally when he woke up, he was covered with silk clothes. So the bracha was actually in the sky. Shama Rav. So when Rav heard about this, v'ikbad, he was makbid, he was upset with Rav Huna. Omar, my time, amritli ki berachticha. Since obviously when I gave you the bracha, it was obviously an ace rotzen for the bracha to be niskayim, why didn't you tell me when I gave you the bracha, v'chein lamar, and the same thing for you, Rebbe. And then the bracha, then I would have had such a bracha as well. So we learn from that. This is where we learn the concept that when somebody benches you, so you bench him back in order that this way, if it is in fact an ace rotzen, then that way the bracha will be mekuyim for the other person as well.
You could have said it at that time, like years later.
Well, that's what he said. So at the time, well, Rav didn't know at the time that it was an Aesirotz. And only years later, when he saw that the bracha was this guy, and now he said, in retrospect, Rav Huna, you should have told me v'chein lamar.
Is there a bracha to have a bunch of people throw clothes on top of
you? Well, the point is, in other words, that he was rich. The point is, how do his daughters and daughters-in-law come to have silk clothing? Obviously, it means that he came into money. We find in other places in Shas that Rav Huna did become quite wealthy. So when he was younger, he was poor. We have this example. We have other examples in the Gemara, but eventually he became rich. So yeah.
The fact is, you never know what's next.
So therefore, he should have right away said, "B'chein l'mayim." Yeah, exactly. So another example, so we had Reb Preda, not Reb Preda, Reb Zakkai, we had with a Chachamim, where his Talmidim asked him, Bameher Achli Yamin. So here's another one. Shaul Talmidim is Reb Elazar ben Shamua, Bameher Achli Yamin. Reb Elazar ben Shamua, by the way, he was one of the Asar Arugim Malchus. One of the Medrashim, and it says that he was 105 at the time. So he obviously was Marech Yamin. So 105 is a pretty advanced age. So with what zchus did you live long? So he tells them, in all my life, I never used, or basic nesis, whatever, I never used the shul or the beis medrash as a shortcut. Now, mi'ikra din, you're not allowed to. But there are actually cases where you are. For example, let's say you went in there to daven, then you're allowed to leave by the other entrance. So he apparently, the idea was he was machmed even on that. Also, for example, you have a din, let's say, I think we're going to have it later on in our parak, that, for example, if there was a path there before the shul was built, then you're allowed to continue using that pathway. Nevertheless, he was machbid not to do that. Number two, we're like, Asaiti al Roshe Am Kodesh. I never stepped over the heads of the holy people, meaning Rashi describes the Talmidim are sitting in the Beis Medrash on the floor. So now he would always make sure he's never going to be late, such that he would have to be walking over their heads because it wouldn't be derech eretz to them. So therefore, he would always make sure to be there before the Talmidim come. And again, there are cases where you're allowed to, but nevertheless, he was machmir on himself not to. And I never duchen without a bracha. Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua was a kohen. Now, what's the chiddush that he didn't duchen, that he always duchen with a bracha? I mean, you have to say a bracha. No, that he, to duchen. To actually go up to the duchen, he always made sure to say the bracha asher k'dushanu b'k'dushasei sh'arim. So the question is, a bunch of them, the Mefarshim asks, so what's the chiddush? Of course, a kohen has to say the bracha. So Marsha says maybe because you could argue that Birkas Kohenim itself is, it's a prerequisite sort of. The mitzvah is you're benching, the Kohenim are benching the Yidden in order that Hashem should bench them. So you could argue maybe such a thing doesn't require a bracha. Nevertheless, he held that it does, and he said a bracha. The Turei Eben says maybe what it was is, maybe Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua was the one who was actually misaken the bracha. Maybe before that, the Chachamim held that you don't need a bracha for Birkas Kohenim. And one reason for that could be al derech, like we know, for example, you don't make a bracha for Birkas HaMazon, even though Birkas HaMazon itself is a mitzvah in the Torah, but you don't make a bracha that you have the chance to say another bracha. So before Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, they may have held that way, that you don't make a bracha for Birkas Kohenim. And he was the one who was misaken the bracha. And then there's a couple of other explanations, one of them being that maybe technically one kohen could say the bracha and everybody else could be yotze, but he was machmed to actually say the bracha himself rather than just rely on somebody, on one of the other kohenim saying the bracha. Asher kedushanu b'kedushasei shel Aaron is how the bracha goes. That Hashem made us holy with the kedusha of Aaron. Tzivanu levarach asami Yisrael
ba'ar. Tzivanu came. It was about five earlier.
That's the point. Birkas Kohenim is a mitzvah in the Torah. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs. But the idea is, the Turei Eben wants to say that maybe previously there was no concept of saying a bracha on it, just like, for example, there's no concept of saying a bracha before benching. But then Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua was misakin. The Turei Eben says maybe he was the one who was actually misakin the bracha that Adayim Azer, the Kohenim said. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow, Best Hashem, with other ones, with other Chachamim, where their Talmidim asked them in what zchus did they live long, and we'll talk about those.
Regarding Birkas Kohanim, how can they make a bracha when they're not even certain that they're Kohanim? It could be considered bracha lebatala, basically.
They have a chazakah being Kohanim, and chazakah is a powerful enough thing that they're allowed to.
They don't have a chazakah. There's a suffix.
No. We have those Kohanim. No. Listen. There's Kohanim Yichus and there's Kohanim Chazakah. It's true we don't have any Kohanim Yichus nowadays, namely ones who have documentary evidence that they trace back to Kohenim. It's true. But they are Kohenim Chazaka. People who are assumed to be Kohenim now, they have just that. They have a Chazaka that they are Kohenim. For certain purposes, that wouldn't be enough. For example, to serve in the Mishmikdash, they need more than that. So when Mashiach comes, then he will clarify all of that. But for purposes of Birkas Kohenim, for example, Chazaka is a powerful thing in Halacha. We see, for example, that Chazaka is even enough. For example, the Gemara in Chulin has a whole sugya about it. For example, we see that chazaka is enough to be able to eat meat. You don't say, for example, what if the animal had a hole in its windpipe at exactly the place where you shechted it. Nevertheless, we say you're allowed to eat meat. The same way we say there's a lot of examples the Gemara brings over there, where we accept chazaka as a valid thing in halacha. So the same way over here, the chazaka is enough for the kohenim to be able to say that bracha. That's it. That the fact that they have a chazaka that they're kohenim.
But technically, they should have three generations. So they should have three generations above them who are Kohanim to have a Chazaka.
No, no, no. First of all, they do. First of all, Kohanim do. They know. How does a person know that he's a Kohen? Because his father was a Kohen, because his grandfather was a Kohen, etc. But Chazaka for this purpose doesn't necessarily require three generations. It just means that he has a Chazaka, that he has a known family tradition that he is a Kohen. That's good enough for purposes. Again, it won't allow him to serve in the Mishmikdash. It won't allow him to eat Truma Daraisa. But to do things like this, it'll allow it to. The truth is, by the way, the Rishonim talk about the possibility based on a Gemara and Shabbos that even if a non-Koyan, even if a Zor does Duchen, it's possible that he's only over on a mitzvah saseh. Because after all, the Pasuk says, Koyse Baruch Hu Bnei Israel, that the Koyanim should bless the Jewish people, implying Koyanim yes, Zorim no. So therefore, if a Zor does it, the most that he's doing is over on a mitzvah saseh, say a couple of Rishonim. So that being the case, that's all the more reason why the Koyanim can do it and don't have to worry about, and they can say, when once they're allowed to do it, then they're allowed to say the Bracha as well on the basis of their Chazaka being.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.